You are listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the Archaeotech Podcast, episode 27, Photogrammetry. I'm your host, Chris Webster. Chris Sims is off tonight. On today's show, we talk to Michael Ashley from the Center for Digital Archaeology and Codify about photogrammetry. We're also going to talk about some best practices for taking field photos. Let's get to the show. Welcome to the show, everyone. Today, we're going to demystify field photography, as I said in the intro. What are the best ways to take basic artifact photos? What scales should you use? Do you need to white balance a crappy point-and-shoot digital camera that your field director gave you? I think our guest is going to have some opinions on that. So let's introduce him. Michael, how's it going?
It's going great.
Awesome. So this is Michael Ashley. He's been on at least one episode before, and we're going to talk today all about photography because this is kind of Michael's wheelhouse. And anytime you talk archaeology, somehow photography ends up coming up. I don't know. But we're going to...
Is there anything other than photography?
Right. I mean, when you get down to it, no. I mean, that's one of the best ways we can document something. We can describe the hell out of it. But if you've got a great photograph of it, I mean, it really is 1,000 words. You know what I mean? So it's I totally agree with you on this. But let's talk... Let's talk real quick. I want to set the stage just in case people didn't hear the other episode you were on. Tell us your quick and dirty background in archaeology and your interest in photography and how you joined the two up.
Yeah, so thanks. And it's great to be back. So yeah, so Michael Ashley, I have this thing called the Center for Digital Archaeology and this new California benefit corporation called Codify Incorporated. And we're working on building digital applications to help all of us archaeology folks and others go paperless and feel good about it. So that's the way we got here was that, back in the day in the shockingly the 1990s to be specific, there was this great transition from film to digital. And I'm a photographer. That's always been the thing that I do. My dad was a photographer. He passed away in 2011. Mm-hmm. So this is the thing I think about. And suddenly I had this huge digital legacy where I had these perfectly happy slides that I still have, and they look stunning and beautiful. And then suddenly have, all this digital stuff. And just to clarify, as we'll talk about, I would never go back to film personally. I mean, I love lots of things about film. I really do. But the advantages of digital, I would say in just the last couple of years, finally, after all this time, can officially trump film for most things. But there's this technical debt that comes along with that, which is how do we make sure that all these images that we take will persist and can really leave behind a durable archaeological record. So that will be the topic of the moment, I think.
Yeah, you made me think about something. What's the biggest thing that we've lost going to digital from film that we just haven't been able to get from a digital standpoint?
Can I tell a real quick story?
Yeah, go ahead.
So I'm not going to say which one, but I have a high school reunion coming up this year. And this is say it's not my 10th. So, and it's interesting, just this weekend. So back in the day, when I was in high school, I was already pretty nerdy in a kind of good way. I was the AV guy, right? All that, mm-hmm. Every single possible stereotype was there. But I got myself onto the, I was in the photography program, and I got myself onto the newspaper and the yearbook and all those types of committees. And we had an award-winning program. It was really fantastic. It was one of the few things at that time that our high school did really well. And just for all you people listening, this is Sir Francis Drake, go Pirates, in Marin County, California. It's now like this hyper elite killer school, but back then it was a bit more rough, just mm-hmm. to say.
Nice.
So rough by Marin standards. I could go on. But anyway, I had my dad's great training. I was actually working in a photo lab, so I really understood film chemistry. And we did this cool thing in the senior year. We took pictures, candids, And color slide photos the entire year. We planned it a year in advance, myself and this wonderful colleague of mine, Vasya Kolan. And at the end of the year, so this, okay, I'm going to say it, it's 1986, okay? So we took all those slides and put them in the carousels, and I rented a dissolve unit, and we, in the auditorium, we had this slideshow for all the seniors, and they lost their minds. They were like, this is so cool. You know, you could see everyone from doing sports to candidates, and it was a very emotional thing. It was wonderful. Over the years, people have passed, as in they have died. I've had families request some of those photos, that's happened. And just this weekend, I went rummaging through some boxes and found the original carousels, because I'm going to have them digitized. And I physically won't even be able to be here. This is the cool part. This is how I'm going to make the transition in this podcast. I physically won't be here when the reunion is happening in August. And I'm pretty bummed. I was really excited to be there. But this is not an opportunity where I can digitize these slides at astoundingly awesome full resolution. And I pulled these slides out, and I'm telling you, Chris, they look as good as the day that I shot them.
Nice.
Okay, now think about that. I have pictures that look as good as the day that I took them back in, you know, 30 years ago. And, you know, and they're there, like they're physically there. I didn't have to transfer them and from a floppy to a US to, you know, to a zip drive, to a USB stick, to a hard drive, to an SSD drive, to a quantum drive, you know, to a laser disc, to a DVD, to a CD. I can do this all day. You know what I'm saying?
Like, yeah.
It's there. It's physical. It's present. It's durable. It's sustainable. And that is something that we definitely have lost in the digital age. And something that we need to recover from.
And can we recover from it?
I don't know.
Yeah. That's the big question, isn't it?
Well, I mean, so a book I highly recommend for everyone, we'll definitely put in the show notes, is called When We Are No More, : How Digital Memory is Shaping Our Future. And this is a fantastic book written by Abby Smith Rumsey, who spent over 10 years working at the Library of Congress and truly is a guru of all things digital. She was on this blue ribbon panel from the White House and Congress. They spent several years trying to understand how to make digital content sustainable. So her book just came out this month in 2016. Mm-hmm. It came out on the 1st of March this year. And I will tell you that it doesn't bode well, because basically what she says, and she's totally right, is that we have given up. We've made some concessions with digital that we never made in human history since the time of writing on cave walls,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, the time of the Egyptians and making pyramids and all that stuff that we do, that we dig up archaeologically, suddenly we've given that up because of the amazing transformative expression that digital gives us, which is, you know, you and I sitting having a podcast right now, and you're in Reno and I'm here in California, and we can do this live and in the moment, which is fantastic. So again, I don't want to get on a bummer. I love it. But there is that slower process of actually inscribing, you know, in writing and transforming a physical medium,
mm-hmm.
just works differently digitally. It is doable. I mean, my full-time job now is to make sure that digital content persists.
Right.
And everything we're about is trying to figure out how to make sure that we can teach that and work with manufacturers and scientists and everyone else to try to figure out what a durable digital record will look like.
Mm-hmm.
But according to pretty much everybody I know that does this for a living, it's kind of mysterious right now. That doesn't mean that we won't solve it, because we're humans and we solve really cool stuff all the time. But it hasn't been solved in 30 years. So I basically will say, I'll just get this out now in case everyone stops listening. Like I said last time, we're only 10 minutes in. If for the foreseeable future, so let's just call it the next, say, 20 years, if you produce digital content and you want that content to persist, I basically think that it is incumbent upon you to be a steward, to not think that corporations are going to take care of that stuff, or that if you give it to an agency, that they will be able to necessarily do it either. There needs to be, this is the beautiful thing about digital, is you can actually make multiple copies. I don't have to be here for my reunion, because the company is going to send me digital copies and put them into Dropbox. Then I can make prints, ironically, and I can make a digital slideshow and hand it to the committee, which, of course, being, you know, high school, is exactly the same people that were the committee years ago.
Right.
So
right.
The same people. So do you get what I'm meaning? Like this is actually a doable thing. So I think what would be great to talk about here would be, you know, how to squeeze the best quality out of that moment where you're taking that photo, things you can do to make that digital file you're going to produce more interesting, which we've learned makes it have a greater chance of success of surviving. And then we could talk about all the really cool 3D stuff too. So I'll start with that.
Okay. Well, before we, I want to say one thing and then we will get actually into field photography. It made me think when you were talking, you know, you've got these perfect slides. They're just, you know, greatest, best of the day, perfect from the day that you took them. Right. So the one thing that I think digital has done for us, and there are some problems with this, but those slides, if you're, you know, hopefully it doesn't, but if your house burned down tomorrow or wherever you're keeping those, then they're gone for good, right? Regardless of how good they are, they're gone for good, right? Those originals are gone. And the one thing I like about the internet, for lack of a better term, just to put a big, huge blanket term on it, is that anytime you put a photo on the internet, chances are it's in more than a few places already. The problem is we don't know where those places are. The problem is we don't have a way to track those photos digitally and to keep track of those. And that's where I think personally for me, the stewardship comes in, is keeping track of where your photos are. You know, even having your photos in one place digitally, as you know, as we'll probably talk about, is still a bad thing because that resource could fail. So I don't know. I feel like every time I put something up, Google immediately downloads it and is sitting in San Francisco somewhere. So who knows, on a barge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, this entire topic is show worthy alone, because let's take the positive version and then the darker version of the same story.
So yeah.
Positive version. And now if we're going to now we have to do all the filtering. Like, are we talking about, and we are, we're talking about archaeological data. We're mm-hmm. talking about the archaeological site record. We're talking about the archaeological site record for CRM, say.
Mm-hmm.
Let's make it about that, as opposed to, say, research archaeology for, say, Greek culture.
Right.
I mean, the difference just right there, let's just take that. So we've just, you and I, in fact, have been spending the last several weeks trying to figure this stuff out around how to produce the durable CRM record digitally. And as we know, here in California, the primary record, you know, 99.9999% of the time is always considered, has to be secured and has to be, is unpublishable because it contains very sensitive information. The exact location of the site, in fact, as we know now, down to the submeter as required by law. So when you attach a photograph to that record, that photograph contains that same level of information. And it, basically, if we have, what people have to understand is, especially, we'll definitely talk about this, if you're using your phone to take pictures, that phone is going to have geolocation information in every single photo that you take, unless you tell it not to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So suddenly we're generating records, photographic records, that can tell you a lot of stuff that you probably weren't thinking that it could. So here's a great example. Working with a CRM firm, going online, trying to put some stuff together for a proposal, go to their site, download some pictures, open up, you know, put the pictures into Adobe Lightroom, and it's like, okay, so now I know that this particular place was this particular location, and it was so precise. It was crazy. Talk to CRM firm, and they go, Everyone in the room turned bright white. They're like, oh my God. I mean, because these were the pictures that were given to their marketing team.
Yeah.
And the marketing team didn't know that you had to strip the metadata out of these. So yes, you can put the photos onto the internet, but you have to think through the entire process. So the positive version of this is, if we're dealing with a project where open access is the goal, then that is actually by far the best option, because mm-hmm. if you can clear the copyright, if you can follow a good practice of generally thinking through how your information is going to be used in the future, and that is like, hey, we're going to have general site pictures, or this is a national park and everyone knows where it is anyway, and we're not talking about like looking at bifaces or diagnostic artifacts, but like really cool, beautiful 3D images of say, you know, a resurvey of, you know, the valley floor of Yosemite. Put that stuff on the internet. That'd be totally rad. That'd be great. No worries. Mm-hmm. But if we're talking about really super sensitive data, then we just seriously have a problem to think about. And that's where I think we should definitely spend some time today talking about how to make data so that it can be shareable more broadly, and ways to produce really incredibly rich data packets, which you can do with digital files, and that is why they're better than film. So that would be my twist, and we'll get into about how to build the most beautiful digital image file that's just packed with all sorts of really great knowledge that can be used, you know, in a lot of really great ways.
Excellent. All right. Well, we're super close to a break, so I think we're going to take one now and then come back on the other side and have a slightly longer segment so we can really get into this. All right. Back in a second.
Archaeology and Ale is a free monthly talk presented by Archaeology in the City from the University of Sheffield Archaeology Department. That's where the archaeology part of Archaeology and Ale comes from. As for the ale part, the talk is held upstairs at the Red Deer, a great local pub on Pitt Street in Sheffield, South Yorkshire, on the last Thursday of every month. If you're in Sheffield, do come along, and don't worry, non-ale alternatives are also available. If you can't make it to Sheffield, never fear. You can listen to the Archaeology and Ale talk every month, right here on the Archaeology Podcast Network. And now, back to the show.
All right, we're back, and now we're really going to dive into field photography here. So let me set the stage. You're working for XYZ Archaeology Company, and you're a field technician, and they hand you your gear. They tell you, okay, for the next 10-day session, you're going to be taking all the photos, and you're going to take the site overviews, you're going to take the feature photos, you're going to take artifact photos, right? And it's usually diagnostic artifact photos. And what they give you is $150, $200, I don't even know how much they cost anymore, a cheap point-and-shoot camera with probably a little lens that comes out where after 5 or 6 days, you'll hear the grinding of the sand inside the thing, and the lens cover won't work anymore. The little auto-retracting lens cover, that always fails. Anyway, that's what they're going to give you. They're not going to give you anything else. They might give you a piece of cardstock with scale bars down either side of it, which will be dirty after the first time you use it, after the first time you set a dirty artifact on top of it. So that's what you're going to get. That's what you're going to get. What do you do in that situation besides throw everything out, quit, and go work for somebody else? What do you do to make your photos not suck? Is it possible with that sort of setup to take decent photos? I'm talking lighting and everything. So I'm going to throw it over to you, Michael, and throw you into your worst nightmare. What do you do in that case?
Well, I mean, the reality of the situation is there's not a whole lot you can do if you're given a really, I mean, if the organization just is going to hand you a crappy point and shoot,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to give you a couple of possibilities here. One is I have on my screen, I did this whole video tutorial about photogrammetry, 3D imaging. We'll talk about that later. But what I talked about in that is that I have an email I get every day from eBay where I can and a Sony NEX 6. So that's a camera, 12 megapixel camera that on eBay right now, it's now been discontinued. It's an amazing camera. I would use it as my primary camera, ladies and gentlemen, over you know, SLRs for lots of things. Because if you're on a survey, do you want to be carrying like a DSLR that's going to get all dusty and, you know, cost you $3,000? Probably not. Not to mention, it's really heavy. So this thing is fantastic. I've used it on kites. I've used it on drones. You can get these things on eBay right now for less than $300.
Nice.
So I guess I'd say the following. Here's a possibility. Yes, you can go out with your crappy point two that they provide you. And then I'm in about 60 seconds, I'm going to tell you everything you could try to do to make that better. Or you could try to get a gold star. You might get fired for this, but maybe not, which would be go out with your phone, especially if it's an iPhone or a decent, any recent, you know, phone, and take another picture. Just do that. Just do that alone. Just don't even do anything differently, but just take another picture with your phone. I guarantee you the picture will be better than the scenario you just described.
Right.
So let's talk about what we can do for the scene. And then, so that regardless of the device, I mean, you know, I got something going on with my eyes right now. I can't wear contact lenses right now. So I'm wearing glasses. And if your glasses are dirty, guess what? You know, so clean the lens, you know, get yourself some lens cleaner, clean that lens, download the manual from Google, go to Google, put the camera into Google and figure out everything there is to know about that camera. If your job is to be the photographer, take their responsibilities seriously. I went to school in California. See, I told you. Here's my drink. Here you go. Take their responsibility really seriously. Why? Because you are the only witness in many cases of that site before you walk past the site, you know, never again, or maybe before the next time, you know, the sands of the Sahara blow it over or whatever, you know? So you have this opportunity and this responsibility to try to do the very best job you can. Take more than one picture. Take more than one picture. I have had so many times to look through people's images, literally millions by now, and they took one picture and that one picture is corrupted. Mm-hmm. Digital files do get corrupted. It happens. Crappy point and shoots guaranteed to happen more often. So, you know, the more expensive cameras actually have built-in error corrections and other things. They'll give you a little error to tell you that something went wrong. So take a couple of pictures. It's not going to hurt you. It doesn't cost you anything, but the situation, the scene. So let's go for artifacts. Get a friend, okay, and have that friend. The bigger the friend, the better. But basically, you want the friend to cast a shadow on that artifact, so that all of the lighting of your scene, everything that you're seeing within the viewfinder, is under the same lighting. If you're dealing, I mean, you know, it's 85 degrees to 150 degrees outside, however hot it is, and you got the it's noon sun, because for whatever reason, wherever you are in the world, when you find the really cool stuff, it's always noon.
Oh yeah,
and there's no clouds in the sky. It's noon and it's cloudless.
Yeah,
that's what it is. The worst possible lighting ever. So at that moment, what you want to do is cast a nice big shadow. I would always carry. We'll talk about that in about 60 more seconds, I promise. But basically, I would always carry some form of shade with me. Mm-hmm. And it can just be something, a parasol. Hell, man, you walk across the desert, and it's my vision. Pull out an umbrella. Seriously, a little umbrella.
Nice.
Perfectly great. Not black, but white, ideally. But something light that you can basically cast a shadow.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so then, now, what you can't do. Most, if we're talking about the crappiest point and shoot, you're not going to have the ability to do the following thing, which, of course, I say, of course, my brain, and that is set that camera to not shoot JPEGs.
Right.
So we'll come back to that, but I will say, if your camera has the ability to shoot what's called camera raw, do it. And if your camera can't do that, then get a camera that can. Now we're back to your phone. If I have a crappy point and shoot and I've read all the reviews on the internet and it's terrible, you know, pull out your phone and take the same picture. So now at least we've got something going on. See if your camera has some capabilities for focus. If I'm shooting artifacts, try to have that artifact fill the frame. This is another thing. This blows my mind. Let's talk about scales right now.
Yeah.
So I have an artifact, and that artifact is, well, let's make it huge. It's 2 inches long, okay? It's massive. And people will put, you know, a 10-inch scale in this frame so that the actual artifact itself is this little tiny thing with this really large scale. If you think about it, I've just lost all of the pixels that are being pointed at that artifact. So, I mean, I want the scale to fill up 2% of the frame if possible. My basic policy is I usually take at least two series of photos, one with and one without the scale. So that's another good option. But time is money. Oh, get a background. You can take the picture in situ, but if in situ is in the plow zone, just saying, right?
Yeah.
Or on a dusty plane, then I mean, get some physical material that's all like a homogeneous gray color. And gray is a great color because then you don't worry about dirt. And put it underneath your artifact. Put the artifact in there. Put a scale and take your picture. Take your picture flat with your friend producing the shade. Mm-hmm. Everything I just described with a little bit of practice, I promise you, you can do in less than 10 seconds.
Nice.
Okay?
Yeah.
Now,
quick question. Let me back up real quick. The camera raw files, some people might have a question on this, and some people may have never actually heard of those before. Can those be opened by basic programs that come with every computer, or do you need special programs like Lightroom, Photoshop, or an equivalent?
Adobe produces a free application called Adobe Camera Raw or ACR. You can just download it from Adobe's site. We'll put a link on the show notes.
Yep.
And it can convert any file from any camera into something called a digital negative format.
Mm-hmm.
And there are you can even go online if you need to do them one at a time. There are apps that will convert the camera raw files into JPEGs.
Hmm.
But the other secret here is that if your camera is capable of shooting raw, then that camera manufacturer has an app that they will also provide for free that will be able to convert that file into a JPEG.
Nice.
Where people screw up is that they actually save the JPEG and the camera raw file. And then because they're lazy, because of time, because of being yelled at, they just take the JPEG from the camera card anyway, and they lose all the benefits of the raw file.
Right. And just so everybody knows, make sure you know what your agency requirements are. For example, Nevada BLM, just 3 or 4 years ago, started requiring TIFF files. And a TIFF file is, you know, it's a pretty decent photo file. There's a lot of data involved in there. And you shouldn't backwards convert a file. Like, don't make a JPEG into a TIFF. It doesn't really work that way, because a JPEG removes information from the photo, and it's just going to make it all funky if you try to convert that into a TIFF. So, which I've seen happen, because they require TIFFs and the cameras only put out JPEGs. So it means you need a new camera if you're in that sort of situation.
Yeah, this is again, nothing, I mean, I've gone through archives where people said, okay, well, yeah, we archive as TIFF files, and it's actually impossible. It is actually mathematically impossible for a TIFF file that's 300 pixels on the side, say, so printable quality for an 8.5 by 11, say, piece of paper, to be 900K. It just can't be that. It's impossible. It's actually right. Impossible. You can have a JPEG file. So if I have a file that's called .tiff that's 900K, and I open it up and it says, yep, and the resolution of this is this. If you open that up in Photoshop, that file would be like 60 megabytes.
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah. The only way that happened is that exactly what you just described. It's like taking a beautiful print, it's like taking a Rembrandt, putting it onto a copy machine and making a copy of it. And then, you know, a color copy. That's literally what you just did. That's when you make a JPEG, that's what you've done. So I love JPEGs. I make them every day. And the workflow we talk about is going from that camera raw into a little tiny bit of production. None of it's complete. It's all non-destructive, and it produces an absolutely astoundingly beautiful full resolution JPEG that's usually about 1/100th of the size.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, what's really astounding about this is that entire process I described is completely automated. So it's not like you have to do extra work. And yes, that can all be done with open source software. But again, if the context we're describing right now is CRM archaeology, we're talking about an app that costs less than $100.
Right.
So with all due respect, to bring it all full circle, if I, you know, if we're going out there with a requirement by law to have a $3,000 or $4,000 GPS unit and a subscription to satellites to get that and a crew that costs money,
mm-hmm.
then all that stuff's going on. Hey, I know, spend $400 and buy a decent mirrorless, as I call them, camera. And I will happily produce a list of suggested cameras that people can get, that they can have, that they can weatherproof and all that. And everyone will be happier.
It is, it just a side note, it is amazing what companies choose to spend money on and what they choose to skimp on. You know, you go into a larger CRM firm's offices and they've got fancy furniture in the lobby and they've got all these nice things. It looks really good. Bowl of candy, you know, all these kinds of things. And then they've got just these shit ass cameras that they're taking pictures with. And that's the really important part. That's the place they should be spending their money on, their equipment for recording archaeological sites, whatever that equipment may be, you know, from cameras to all the other stuff you need. And it's just amazing, the mindset. I don't know what it is towards gear. I mean, you and I have talked to people about iPads. Don't even get me started on that. You know, oh, iPads are too expensive. Yeah, they're too expensive if you don't see saving $200,000 a year as a value. So, you know, whatever.
Well, in fact, really quickly on that, just to say, I mean, when you asked the question initially, I was thinking, well, maybe, I think the actual answer is buy an iPad.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, you can't shoot camera raw files on tablets, and you can't shoot camera raw files on iPhones and Samsung Galaxies and Androids. It just isn't an option right now. You can actually generate TIFF files. That's cool. But the benefits, what we're talking about here is, in an ideal situation, we're talking about generating a durable accounting of a scene.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that is so totally cool about photography now, and it's literally been an explosion in the last couple of years, especially now with drones coming out and DJI basically flooding the market and GoPros and all this, and a huge renaissance towards better resolution, not in terms of size of pixels, but just in terms of quality of image.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about the ability to have images that actually are measurable. Okay. So, you know, if you're going to make an ortho photo that you want to drop in for your site plan and drop the sucker into your ArcGIS and all that, you're going to want, you know, there's work to be done there. Well, if you actually use a camera to subscribe, an NEX6 or an SLR, and take a couple of pictures, and literally it's not that many, you're able to get, we actually have a conference we're going to this in the end of the week. We're getting, in 5 minutes of photography, we're getting, you know, precision 3D images that are accurate to 6 millimeters over
nice.
over a five meter square. Okay. Proven 5 meter square, 6 millimeters of accuracy. You take it and you drop it in ArcGIS and you're done. You've saved hundreds of hours and over a year, probably thousands. I mean, how cool is that?
Yeah.
And it's a little bit of training. And this is like, if I'm going to pull all the snob here, it's a little bit of training compared to, I mean, it's a little bit more difficult than jumping out of an airplane, which requires virtually no training, apparently.
right.
But, you know, I mean, but it's not like learning how to rock climb. So I mean,
yeah,
it's not that much training. And you're going to be able to, I guarantee you this, it's going to be easier to learn than how to actually use a data logger the right way.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, how to use ArcGIS. So it's just the coolest thing ever. And I would absolutely encourage everyone to do that. But I think we have more basics to talk about after your break.
Yeah. So I want to really get into photogrammetry after this next break. And I think we're going to skip the app of the day segment, which I didn't tell you about anyway. So, but I know you can pull an app out of your ass in 3 seconds. That'd be a trick, actually. No. So in the last 3 or 4 minutes, though, of this second segment, just go down, because we've talked about how to take the photos. We've talked about stuff like that. Run down your ideal list of things you would have in the field if you're the field photographer. Now, I'm going to set the scene for you there. You're doing 10 miles a day survey. You've got a backpack with 5 liters of water in it. It's 110 degrees out, and you have to carry everything you need for these photos, and you're doing you're doing survey and you're taking photos as you go along, whether it's diagnostic artifacts, isolated features, or you stop and record a site or something like that. And you're not going back to the truck all day. So you've got everything with you. What's your ideal equipment setup in those horrendous conditions?
All right. And in 5 minutes or less, and how many of us are there on the team?
You've got a standard crew of four. I would say this is a Western crew for everybody else listening. There's a Western crews typically have maybe 3 or 4 people in it. And often one person will be tasked to take photographs for the entire site. All the features, artifacts, everything. So one person will carry the camera.
And,
typically.
And when that person finds something that's really cool, can they borrow another human to help them?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you're doing site recording, though, ideally, no, because they have their own jobs. Now, it's not to say that we don't do that. If you just simply can't get your scene set for your photograph, you'll borrow somebody. But ideally, you're doing it on your own because everybody has responsibilities.
Okay, cool. So
yeah.
I tend to be a lone wolf on photography anyway, and that's all fine. So I'm going to describe two kinds of photography and say right now, you absolutely could have everything. I've done this plenty of times. Everything you need, it can be all lightweight. I would have the following things. I would definitely have an iPad or a phone.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We talked about, let's make the conditions even more brutal. A condition where you can't have a radio.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I mean, I basically have set my conditions to, you cannot have a radio. You cannot transmit anything, but iPads that have the ability to have a data plan, have a really great GPS built into them.
Yep.
As does your phone. Every single phone does. So that's one thing. So, I would have a small mirrorless camera. So again, an NEX or an A6000 or the new versions are about $500 with me. Mm-hmm. Now I will put on to, the show notes for you this fantastic color card. This card is called the 24 color card by cameratracks.com. They're $10. They are smaller than a business card. This is like 2 by 3 inches. This card I have, each of the little color blocks is 1 centimeter.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a fantastic thing. On the back of it, it's a white balance, and it has a barcode on it, so that it can actually use this to truly get to color balance the images. Even if they're a crappy picture taken with a crappy point shoot you talked about earlier, this could save you completely. Okay,
nice.
Think shade versus bright sun versus cloudy versus fluorescent lighting versus tungsten that your eyes can handle. As we all know, cameras just go crazy and then everything's looking all very kind of green Twin Peaks in not a good way sort of way. So that color check in your pocket, a scale of multiple sizes, little teeny scales for little tiny things, 50 meter, half a meter scale would be a fantastic one to have in my bag. And a full meter scale, can be made out of a fantastic material that's super light that doesn't take anything. Carry a monopod if you can. They're basically, I have a carbon fiber monopod and it basically weighs nothing. And I can use that on with a $3 adapter from Amazon. I can use that on an iPad, my mirrorless camera, my iPhone, whatever. So I got flags out there. I got artifacts. It's just me. I'm running around. I'm going to use my physical body to produce that shade, or I'm going to produce a physical shade. And basically think Batman, think wings, just, you know, anything I can do to produce a shade. Again, if I have a monopod or a tripod, even I can actually use that with a clamp to make a bigger shade if needed. So for all the, I feel very confident that a single person can do all of the artifact photography to publication quality. Okay. Again, a physical piece is something about the size of a book, 8.5 by 11, will handle most artifacts. Looking through these things, larger objects, at some point you're gonna have to phone in a friend.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm gonna have a friend come over and help me out, we're gonna do something that's larger than say 20 centimeters or up to a half meter or up to a full meter, that's really gonna be worth, again, these portable shades, they weigh nothing, they just pop out, and I can make a bigger shade, and I'm gonna take those pictures too. Finally, site photography. Now, a whole other segment, I'm sure, on UAS or dealing with drones. So let's assume you can't do that.
Right.
I'm also going to assume that you can't even use a kite, although
right.
As cool as that is. Although that is definitely an option because there's no legal requirements why you can't do that. But for quick and dirty, if I'm going to do something, you're basically going to try. That's where, again, having a better camera that has a wider lens to be able to get those shots. If you're dealing with 1 o'clock in the afternoon, you have to do the best you can do. And that's where camera raw will save you, because I can deal. I'm getting in camera aperture speak, many stops of light that allow us to adjust images that are super bright and super dark and everything in between. And for that, I know you're being asked to take the one picture, but what you want to do is take many different pictures that can be combined at different exposures to get that total awesome money shot of the site. Mm-hmm. So I know we're about out of time on this segment, but love to talk more about the site photography, and that might be a great transition into photogrammetry.
Indeed. We'll talk about that next after this short break.
The CRM Archaeology Podcast brings together a panel of cultural resource management professionals to discuss the issues that really matter to the profession. Find out about networking strategies, job hunting, graduate programs, and much more. We'll often feature interviews with college professors, CRM business owners, and experts as well. Check out the show on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/CRM Arc Podcast. Let's get back to the show.
Okay, we're back. And when we left off last time, we were getting into site photography. So, Michael, why don't you pick it back up there, and we'll talk about the glorious site overviews.
Okay, so let me set some scenes here. So I know that on the CRM side, and I'm hoping that, you know, everyone doing archaeology and dealing with all sorts of site photography is listening. I know that on the CRM side, there's not a whole lot of motivation, because there's it is what it is. If you're a human, and of average height, and then you're somewhere between, average height, somewhere between, say, 4 feet tall and six, somewhere in there, and that's what you are. And if you have a little point to it, what are you going to do? So we'll talk a bit about some things you can do, but I am going to once again describe some ideals. So let's first of all talk about compliance archaeology, or archaeology for that's being done here in the U.S.
Right.
So I'm really tight with some folks from the BLM, specifically a recently retired individual named Tom Noble, and another fantastic woman who's really been the vanguard. These two have been the vanguard of this concept of photogrammetry, and I'll explain what that means in a second.
Okay.
For the seven people that don't know. Just kidding. Lots of people that have no idea what that is. Even though it's been around since the time of Da Vinci, which I cover in another conversation, but it has a dumb term. It's I just call it 3D imaging, or 3D photography. So basically, what they have been doing, and this goes beyond. So here in archaeology, we do things we do whatever we can get away with in compliance archaeology. I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean that time is always against you. We get that, but the fact is that once you understand how easy it is to do this methodology and to do it well, it's not costing you any more time. You make up that time in other ways. Now, in paleontology, so we're talking about dinosaur tracks. They're used to recording things with extraordinary detail and really getting it right. The technique we're talking about of just taking multiple pictures that have 80%, 60 to 80% overlap is literally all you need to do to get something that's better than the sum of its parts. That's what we're talking about. So, all right. So let me set a scene here. So you're out there, you found a site, and the site, let's just face it, the site is not going to fit in this particular scene into your point and shoot in a landscape kind of horizontal format. So panoramas, taking multiple pictures that might be a way. But the technique we're talking about really is about turning the camera actually sideways into a portrait mode or into a vertical format and just take lots of pictures. Again, we'll have the show notes. We'll talk about technically how to do this. Again, it's not hard. But what it comes down to is you take a series of pictures that have overlap, And what you get is that the software can actually figure out all of those different positions that you've done and put them together into a single photographic mosaic that will render out a fantastic image. And that's a way, even if you can even do that with your phone. If your objective is not to produce 3D data, but to produce a really beautiful overview of your site, that's a really great technique. Now, unfortunately, that's not going to get you an overview if you're dealing with like a site that's 100 by 100 meters square.
Mm-hmm.
The only way to do that, if you really want to have the whole site's extent in a single image, is to go up. So that's where I'm very, very serious about like kite imaging. We're doing an analysis right now with the National Park System of looking at like how we might bring in kites or other types of imaging that we can use to handle that. But it's just keep it on the ground for now. So back to our mirrorless camera. For the overview images, some very basic things you can do. Read the manual. I know it's not exciting, but it's the worst time to read the manual would be when you're already in the field.
Right.
And bring extra batteries. So figure out what kind of batteries are. Buy them on Amazon. Write yourself off a tax deductible receipt and get a couple extra batteries. Okay. Just do that for me. Thanks. Okay.
Nice.
Public service announcement is over. So. You're basically locking the exposure or locking the focus. You're going to take a series of pictures, and those pictures will be blended together with software that is either free or very, very cheap. It can be very expensive, but it doesn't need to be into this photo mosaic. So if we're just doing a panoramic image of taking a series of images and putting them together, Adobe Lightroom, which is $149 or $10 a month, commercial, that's not educational, commercial, so that your company definitely could afford 10 bucks a month.
Mm-hmm.
You take the pictures, you put in a new version, you hit a button, and it just blends them all together into a single image, and it will be great. If you want something that's actually going to be that you can then hand to the GIS department, even if you are the GIS department, then for that, yes, you're going to have to do some additional work. And you're really going to want to use a camera that can that we have a little bit more control over in terms of the actual image quality.
Right.
So those are the first tips. And the other one's really easy. I know that the ultimate result in CRM might be one or two site overview photos, but you may as well take more. You know, I mean, you're there. You may not ever go back. And I can tell you from now, over 20 years of doing this, that it's those other pictures that you didn't think that were really important that almost always become important. You know, that's the thing. You're producing an archaeological legacy. And the best thing is trust your instincts. Trust the hairs on the back of your neck. Trust your gut. If you're in a situation that you cannot understand, if you look at the picture and you hand that camera to somebody else and say, "Tell me what this is a picture of," and they don't know what it is, no one else will know what it is 10 years from now. No one's going to know.
Right.
And if that, then you may as well do a podcast because there's no reason to have visual evidence of it. And I'm serious about that. So I'll end this little segment by saying that's where having a second person is really helpful, because mm-hmm. how I always roll is to have two people. I have one person that's actually clicking the button, and I have another person that's actually taking notes. And that's fantastic. I mean, basically describing the scene. I'm telling them what my photo number is right there and not expecting the office to figure that out later. Blending things together. Record the time that you're recording. If you're using a physical notebook and you have and you synchronize the time of your, that's another thing we always do. Oh my God, can't believe I didn't mention that. Always set the time of every device in advance. Okay.
Yeah.
Just do that. But if I say, look, it's 6:15, 14 seconds, but 6:15 p.m. PDT right now.
Mm-hmm.
And the person just writes that down in their notebook. And then we're taking 17 pictures, and the person writes down 17 pictures taken. Oh, my God. And then the other thing that will be a huge time saver is, and when you're done, have them write down the time that you end.
Yeah.
That last beat, that's the best thing I've said all day. If they do that, if you do that, you're going to find, without getting all mystical about digital technologies to save you, to do all this stuff magically, that alone will be a huge saver of time, but also just produce a better record later. So that's some stuff.
That's a good point. I like the thing about the times, because that would have saved us in a few circumstances on my last project. Even though we were taking photos with iPads and things like that, there were some synchronization issues, and it would have helped to know the beginning and ending times that we recorded a site from, so we can group those photos by time. And also, I think, and some people might be listening to this thinking, yeah, sure, I'll take 100 photos and pick the best one, but my company freaks out when their photos are out of sequence and I'm missing, you know, image file 0021593. Like, where the hell is that? And, well, I deleted it. And I've worked for plenty of companies where you don't delete it. Well, if you delete something, it has to go in the photo log that you deleted that photo. Otherwise, they think it's lost or something like that. I don't think we're going to get into that, because I'm hoping that situation is changing. In fact, at DigTech, you know, we took all our photos with iPads and we didn't care what the number on the photo was that the iPad took. We just, if somebody took a bad photo, I told them just delete it and take it again, because they're taking it in the photo log that we created. So that was the best situation. And then, of course, there's other things coming down the line that will solve all these problems. So I really don't want to go down that rabbit hole too much. However, let's talk in the last 10 minutes here. This is the photogrammetry episode. Let's talk about straight up photogrammetry. You know, let's get into what that means, and what you can do from a CRM standpoint, what you can do on the excavations and things like that. So what's your definition, Michael, of photogrammetry, just for anybody that hasn't really thought about it?
So this is my current kind of favorite topic. I'm just going to pull up the actual definition for us while we're at it. So basically, photogrammetry is defined as the, quote, art, science, and technology of obtaining reliable information about physical objects in the environment through recording, measuring, and interpreting photographic images and patterns of electromagnetic radiant imagery and other phenomena. In other words...
Done. End of the show.
Right? I mean, yeah. That's just, you can get that, you just Google it. Why? That let me demystify that for you.
Right.
So since photography, so I want you to get, I mean, most of us are not old enough to remember that the little GIF viewer where you put the little thing in the carousel and it had, you know, you could put the two eyes up to it and you saw images in quote unquote 3D.
Right.
Which, oh, by the way, that's every movie you see today is exactly that same type of technology. It's two images presented to your eyes that are slightly different that through parallax produce something that looks like 3D.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. However, how the human eye works, of course, is that we're taking different perspectives from our two eyes, and our brain knows how far our eyes are apart, and it's doing the math for us, and that's how we get depth. That's the cool thing. That's what we get. Hence, Da Vinci. They figured out, like, okay, so I have these optics, you know, I'm seeing things from different perspectives, from different points of view. If we combine the data together, we can actually solve for X, or in this case, Z. We can actually solve and get 3D. So what's happened in just the last couple of years, because the software it's basically, we can all blame or thank Agisoft Photoscan for basically deciding that everyone else is charging thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars for really hard to use software. We're going to give the software away basically to educational, for educational institutions, and for everybody else, you can get into this for like $80.
Nice.
And that software is like a $3,000 package in comparison. And it's overwhelmingly taken over the market. There are other ones now that are just as good and do other things. But the point is that it has now become a consumer product.
Mm-hmm.
However, this is where everything falls apart. So you have to ask yourself the same question you should be asking whether you're using using a GPS or tape. What is the actual result that you need to get? What is the result that you wish you could get? This is where things get really interesting. My only point is, if I have a camera in my pocket, that NEX, and I take a bunch of pictures and I put them together and I don't process them, I can still give the company the overview shot that they want. But I also have banked something that can produce, as I mentioned before, millimeter accuracy if I take the right set of pictures.
Right.
This is what's transformative about this method. Whereas if I do a laser scan survey, the intent of that laser scan survey is to produce metric data. Here, I could just take pictures, and if I want to produce metric data, I can. Now, the caveats or the gotchas are fairly severe. Tom Noble says it so perfectly. If you do this series right, if you take good pictures, and here's his pretty kind of chill way of looking at this. The picture needs to be in focus. Okay, let's just start with that. All right, and all of the pictures of a particular series should actually be in the quote the same focus. So you should actually use it's a manual focus, hence kind of eliminating phones. But let's just set that aside for now.
Yeah.
Basically, the same focus, a good picture, 80% coverage in every direction. So if I go kind of linearly across a rock art's face, I need to come up and have 80% coverage again in these kind of strips. But if you do that, you're going to get really great 3D data. And that's the difference between what we're talking about. What's happening is that people are producing 3D models from this data. And when you actually look at it, it's just not very good.
Mm-hmm.
That's the learning curve. And you know what? We dealt with the same thing when digital cameras started. Oh, wait, we did that now. It's called Instagram. This is another, I mean, seriously, right?
Right.
So, if, you know, the thing I would say, and I know we only have a couple of minutes left. When Nefra Matthews, who is fantastic, she's actually out here visiting at a conference for geology right now here in San Francisco. What she says is like, if you're out there, just literally, there's like no excuse to not take the pictures. It's so easy to do.
Mm-hmm.
And you're banking something that future generations can actually use. And that's astounding. And so to make it all full circle, the very first question you asked, if I have two CRM firms and they're both competing for my business and I'm the client,
right?
Which do I want? I mean, it didn't take you any more effort to get me a better picture. That's pretty amazing. I think the agencies, we're going to start seeing more and more pressure to produce better data. I can tell you right now that's definitely happening at the governmental level. It's like, what are we getting? How much is it costing us? Why are we paying hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars? And the thing that is going, this is it. If I will be quoted, I'm happy to be quoted for this. The thing that's going to drive in the next 10 years financial decisions about how things are is, can the data that you're generating actually be saved? That's going to be the question.
Mm-hmm.
Like not should it, but can it? And
right.
You know, and producing data isn't just about taking pictures or producing paper site records. It's about, can those things be combined to produce a durable record efficiently without you physically needing to be there? Hence the kind of the definition of archaeology, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's become your wallet is archaeological as soon as you've lost it. You know, if it doesn't have your driver's license in it, and nobody can actually identify you. So if this data set doesn't make any sense to anybody and it's being turned into the state of the agency or the client, we're really asking ourselves, what good is it? Here is a cheap and dirty technique that can produce astoundingly high quality data that I basically think should be taught to anyone who's out there doing archaeology. It's easy enough to do. And again, another plug, if you happen to be in the Bay Area at Santa Cruz this Friday, there'll be a conference. I think it's pretty much full. There might be some more space specifically on this topic, and it's really become a very popular topic. Certainly something that I'm happy to talk about in verbose detail over beers at any time. So catch us at the SAAs. I'm not sure when the podcast comes out, but I think it's coming out in time.
Mm-hmm.
So those are my deep thoughts.
Nice, nice. All right. So in the last couple of minutes here, I just want to bring up, say it in a different way, what you just said right at the end there, Michael, which was basically, you know, we're looking at our legacy. You know, we're banking data for future researchers by taking all these photos and by making this thing, even if you don't know what you're doing, even if you don't know how to make a 3D, you know, a 3D image of your site overview or something like that, take as many photos as you can, store them with the site, store them somewhere else, and we'll figure, well, that's a whole other conversation, a whole other podcast. But store them, because we do that with so much other data. We collect all kinds of samples. We collect all kinds of information that we're not going to do anything with. And we know that, especially as CRM archaeologists, we're likely never going to do anything with some of those, some of the information we collect. But we collect it because we know we're the last people to see that in most cases, especially in, say, Nevada or on a road construction project or something like that. Chances are, really good chances are, you are literally the last person to see it. So make the case for taking as many photos as you possibly can and you know, preserve it for the future. And hopefully, you know, data storage is coming down in cost, and hopefully new methods for long-term storage of this stuff, you know, will be coming around, and it won't be an issue. But I'm thinking just do it. The worst they could do is just delete all the stuff you took. So, but you can't go back out and take them once it's destroyed. So, let's just, we're pretty much out of time, but do you have anything you want to wrap this up with? Any last words, in the last minute or so?
Well, since it's about photography, I'll say this, kind of back to the When We Are No More book by Abby Smith, and about thinking about our kind of persistence of memory thing here to make it a bit bigger than just CRM archaeology. So, you know, setting aside cloud, you went back to the fire thing, and people think, what happens, you know, during a fire? What do people save? You know, you go back, you get, hopefully in the following order, you get the kids, you get the pets, and you get your photos.
Yep.
So in the other adage of a photo is worth 1,000 words, kind of true, right? I mean, you know, this is the thing. So I'm not actually suggesting that people go and take, if you come back, if it's your first time out on an outing, you come back and you've taken 300 photos and you're asked to take two, it's probably not going to work out so well. But I would say that if you think about all the words you need to write down to describe a site in a thorough way that can really make sense to people, I would suggest pick up a big pile of site records and see if you can make sense of them without the photo.
Right.
That's the thing. That's my point. And it's really just that. This is a completely doable thing. It's easy to do better. And it is completely overlooked. It is not taught. It's insane. And it's still mind-altering to me that in 2016, that you know, archaeological photography, as if it were a special thing, but basically taking really good pictures, is actually something that has to be extracurricular. Mm-hmm. So that's what I hope that will change. Anyone listening, I hope this sparks some conversation. Always interested in talking about this. There's some fantastic people out there doing this. Everyone should learn how to do it. It's not that hard. The technology is totally here, and there's really just no excuse not to do it. So go for it. And it's fun. Did we mention it's actually fun? Like, if someone said, hey, your job today on this survey, it's, by the way, that's always only the job I ever get. But no, you know, just saying. Oh, really? You get to take the pictures. Like, I got to take the pictures. Wait. And if you're good at it, you get called over to take the picture of the really cool stuff.
Yeah.
It's amazing. I mean, you know, being at like Çatalhöyük and Stonehenge and all these really amazing sites and having people say, you are the one I want to go over there and see the really cool stuff. That's awesome. So that's your candy that goes with the stick. It's like, it's not just good for you. It's also a lot of fun. So
nice.
I'll leave it on that.
All right, well, we're going to close there, and since we didn't do the app of the day segment, I will just mention really quickly, since this is coming out a few days before the SAAs, go download the SAA conference app. It's just look up SAA Orlando or SAA 2016 in the iPhone App Store, at least. I haven't looked at it. I don't know if they have an Android app, honestly, but look that up. It's surprisingly good. Still has a few deficiencies that I'd like to see corrected at some point, but it's still surprisingly decent. There's a lot of information, and you can add stuff right to a calendar, and it's pretty good. So use that for scheduling, and let's try to make it so we don't see the computer abstract station anymore, because that's totally ridiculous, and I can't believe it's still at the SAAs. But anyway, that and paper books. I mean, what the hell? Let's use our membership dues for something else. But
another topic. But yeah. The app is actually really great, and I've heard nothing but good stuff. So kudos to the SAA for getting that going.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. All right. Well, thanks, Michael, and we'll catch you around again when we want to talk about all the other stuff that we didn't get time to talk about and led to. This was pretty much an episode, a series building episode where we just go back through here, and every 5 minutes we say, "Yep, there's a show topic, there's a show topic." So we'll do that.
Sounds great. Thank you.
That's it for another episode of the Archaeotech Podcast. Links to some of the items mentioned on the show are in the show notes for this podcast, which can be found at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/Archaeotech. If you like the show and want to comment, please do. You can leave comments about this or any other episode on the website or on the iTunes page for this episode. You can also email us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com or use the contact form on the podcast webpage. If you'd like us to answer a question on a future episode, email us. Use the contact form on the website or tweet your questions with the hashtag Archaeotech or tag @ArcPodNet in your tweet. Please share the link to this show wherever you saw it. If you'd like to subscribe to this podcast, you can do so on iTunes or on Stitcher Radio. You can also type the name of the podcast into your favorite podcasting app and subscribe that way. Don't forget to go over to iTunes and leave a review of the show. It helps us get noticed so more people can find our podcast and benefit from the content. Also, send us show suggestions and interview suggestions. We want this to be a resource for field technicians everywhere, and we want to know what you want to know about. This show is produced by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US dollars a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.